Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, January 19th. I'm Ray Graff. Today it's the Copyright Forum, and joining us to answer your questions about intellectual property are Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood. As of the first of the year, Winnie the Pooh is in the public domain. Ernest Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. Well, some 400,000 sound recordings made before 1923. So if you want to bootleg the Enrico Caruso albums, now could be the time. I'm not suggesting you do that. If you have a copyright question, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. It's Paul Rapp, it's Bill Westwood, it's the Copyright Forum. It comes your way right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's the Copyright Forum, and to answer your questions, we have theoretically two guests with us today. Paul Rapp is an intellectual property lawyer and writer. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, and businesses involved in the creative economy. He lectures widely on intellectual property issues. And Bill Westwood is also with us. He's one of the country's leading medical illustrators. He has drawn more spleens than anyone in the world. It's always great to have a professional member and past president of the Association of Medical Illustrators with us. If you have a copyright question, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll start with you, Bill Westwood. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm theoretically here.
Yeah, Paul.
And ready to answer questions.
Paul Rapp is actually not here at the moment. And I was in contact with Paul. So a little inside baseball for our listeners. Usually there are three guests on this program. Polylaw is one of them. When we are all over the phone, as we have been since the Omicron kicked in again, we do phone guests, and we have only two guest lines. And so Polly drew the short straw. Paul and you were going to be on. And now Paul is, you know, maybe he's got car trouble or something, or maybe he's...
I hope he's on, because he's the go-to guy when it comes to the really legal aspects of answering a lot of these questions.
Well, I have news for you. You are now the go-to guy as of right now, Bill Westwood.
This is frightening for all of our listeners.
Ah, well, remember, we have 47 minutes to go, so we're going to make it happen. The number to call is 800-348-2551 if you want to test Bill Westwood's expertise. 800-348-2551. I mentioned at the top of the show, Bill, that Winnie the Pooh is now in the public domain. This happened as of the first of the year. Many things became public domain that were done from 1926 and before.
Right.
The Sun Also Rises from Ernest Hemingway. Bunch of movies, Buster Keaton movies and Rudy Valentino and whatnot. Oh, my gosh. Hang on just a sec, Bill. Paul Rapp, the late Paul Rapp is here. How are you doing?
I'm good now.
Oh, boy. You don't know how good that makes me feel that you're here.
What happened to you, man?
I'm sorry. I was pulled away from the phone, and I'm back.
All right. You know, well, as an attorney, I understand billable hours come first. And so it's nice to have you here pro bono. I was just talking to Bill about the fact that Winnie the Pooh is now in the public domain, but not Tigger. I saw that Winnie the Pooh and some of his friends, including Piglet and Eeyore, they're in the public domain. Tigger, however, is not. And Disney figures into this as well. I guess Disney bought, well, they bought something in 1961, the versions of the characters. How does that work, Paul Rapp?
They may have come up with representations of the characters. You know, I mean, they don't have, if the character's in the original book and in the original illustrations, everything goes into the public domain. But if changes are made or alterations are made or if characters are made or they change the way the character looks, those changes, you know, the copyright protection starts when those changes are made.
Newly drawn characters would be given, if they're not, you know, too closely, I assume, derived from the originals, would be given their own copyright protection.
But as far as you know, I'm good to start my Winnie the Pooh fan fiction this week, right?
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, you can add werewolves and you know and all that kind of stuff. But and this has happened to Disney before. I mean, with Grimm's fairy tales and you know other things that Disney has adopted. You know, the fairy tales remain in the public domain, but Disney's representation, the look and feel of, you know, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, for example, remain Disney's property until they independently go into the public domain.
But, you know, as we all know, Disney is not litigious, and they'll just roll over if you violate their copyright. Isn't that right, Bill?
Of course.
The number to call here if you have a copyright question is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Bill Westwood is here. Paul Rapp is with us today. And I sent a couple of articles. I don't know if you guys had a chance to see them. I assume, Paul, you were doing some work and did not see them. I'll give you a chance.
That's correct. I have not seen them.
I'll give you a chance to check your
own. I did see them. The one that was that I'd already commented on publicly was the bill, the New York State bill that was presented to Governor Hochul, Assembly Bill 5837, which basically would have forced authors and publishers to license certain ebooks to libraries. Hochul, fortunately, from my perspective at least, vetoed this.
No, okay, hang on. Now let's explain.
Maryland and several other states did not, and Maryland has enacted the bill, which I think will be overturned by the Supreme Court because only the federal government can pass laws that have to do with copyright.
All right, but let's get some backstory on this. And the Association of American Publishers contend that the measure in Maryland runs afoul of federal copyright law, I think. And the Maryland Attorney General said, no, that is not true. I don't know if you have any more background you can give to our more general listeners on that.
Paul, do you? I haven't read that much about Maryland's defense because I just happened to see right before we came on what you had sent. But I think any law basically that's affecting copyright, I don't see why that wouldn't Maryland's law wouldn't run afoul of copyright law.
That law went into effect on the first of the year. It requires publishers offering ebooks to consumers in the state that they offer a license to the works to public libraries on, quote, reasonable terms. I guess that might be the sticky wicket, Paul.
Well, but keep this in mind. Copyright law currently gives authors the option to negotiate rates with libraries and to determine whether or not the authors are willing to license their works in exchange for that rate. What these laws do, the New York law that was vetoed and the Maryland law puts works that, for example, authors have prepared and even works of mine that might be in one of those books, it allows those to be licensed without my having any say about it or without an author having any say about it. And that's just not right.
Paul Rapp.
Well, yeah, except that publishers, as long as there have been publishers, you know, have been big time enemies of public libraries. I mean, they wish libraries did not exist. They've started initiatives to try to privatize libraries, you know, and libraries are a public blessing, and someone's got to push back against the publishers. And, you know, the constitutional issues involved here, I frankly had not heard about this law, you know, but I'm I'm generally in support of it. I think it's much less that and the publishers are going to say they're representing the authors, and the publishers really, you talk to a great many published authors with major publishers, they're going to tell you they have an antagonistic relationship with the publisher. The publishers are there representing themselves when they start, jacking up ebook access to libraries. I'm in favor of the law, but I would have to study it to talk about the constitutional part. I mean, obviously Bill's right. I mean, matters of copyright are exclusively federal matters. So I don't think that New York State or any of these other states would be putting their face in a fan and signing bills that are obviously unconstitutional. But I would have to really look at it first.
Well, let's take a quick break. Oh, go ahead, Bill. You wrap that up, and then we'll take a break.
Well, let me just wrap it up quickly. I read at least a couple of defenses. By the way, the Authors Guild was very much against this law. And I read a couple of defenses whereby, the libraries actually are able to license some of these ebooks very inexpensively, as it stands right now.
That's a bad thing.
And just like regular books, and the Authors Guild is the evil empire as well. And Ooh. Don't get me started about them.
Oh boy. Okay. You know what? I think there's some antagonism here, and frankly, I am loving it. Let's take a quick break here.
So
we're gonna let things just stew.
Sharpen our swords while we take a break.
Exactly. Bill Westwood in one corner, Paul Rapp in the other corner. We'll come out swinging after the break. It's Vox Pop on WAMC Copyright Forum today with Bill Westwood and Paul Rapp. The number to call if you have an intellectual property question is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Will in Kingston wants to know the difference between sound recording and songwriting copyrights. Will writes, can you explain that difference between a sound recording and a songwriting copyright, and perhaps provide examples of when a musician or musical group may have to file one or the other or both? And that's from Will in Kingston.
Yes. Paul McCartney and John Lennon wrote Hey Jude, and the Beatles recorded Hey Jude. Lennon and McCartney can go get the composition copyright. Lennon, McCartney, Ringo, and George, as the Beatles, can get the sound recording copyright. Otis Redding recorded Hey Jude famously with Duane Allman on guitar, and Otis Redding can go get a sound recording copyright for Hey Jude.
Right.
As good, and if Ray here wanted to record Hey Jude,
oh, that would be bad. That'd be very bad.
He could. and I'll play guitar, and Bill could play drums, and then it would really be questionable. Because I can't play guitar, and I'm not sure if Bill can play drums.
Yeah,
but
I can't do much of
right.
That. That's good. Yeah, let's table that idea, and we'll get back to your point.
But then Ray, Bill, and I would be able to go get a sound recording for Hey Jude, for a version that no one would listen to.
Well, you know what? People listen to William Shatner singing it, so I mean they might listen to
that's
us.
That's right. William Shatner has a copyright for the sound recording of Hey Jude. But they're two distinct. One is the composition, the song, and the other is the recorded performance of the composition, and those are two very separate things and two very separate copyrights.
And more importantly for the federal government, two separate fees. Now, I have actually done this, and you got to pay for the batch of the songs that you've recorded and then the songwriting ones as well, so it's cha-ching for the federal government.
Well, you can get them the same where, you know, the performers and the writers are exactly the same. You can get the composition and the sound recording copyright on one application, except increasingly that is rare. You know, I've had guys come to me, or acts, you know, come to me with albums, and every song has a different matrix of songwriters.
Yeah.
And so that means that can get really expensive really fast. You can do the whole album on behalf of the performer or the band. You can do the sound recording with one, but then the songs you have to do separately if the songwriting combinations are different. You have to do different applications for each one.
Yeah, it's
and
a lot of fun.
Time consuming and annoying and expensive.
It sure does. Our guests today, Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood. It's the Copyright Forum. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Leonard in East Jewett. Leonard, you're on.
Hello. I had a question about the finding the owner of
okay. Whether or not, Leonard, just a moment. If you're not driving, and I don't want you to be dangerous, but if you're not driving, can you go?
No, I'm in a car, but I pulled over.
Okay. Can you get off speakerphone? Because it sounds like you're on the moon.
Okay.
All right. Standing by. NASA.
Sorry about that.
There we go.
My question is where to find the copyright owner of various songs. I'm having that issue right now with a very small publication, and I've been looking for a long time for one particular singer-songwriter. And I had to go to a book that had works about him, and there were some lyrics of his. The book that gave me then the copyright owner, but they had sold to somebody else, and then they had sold to somebody else. Yeah. And I was able to find that online, but I could not find the original copyright owner online through any searches.
Hmm. What was the date of the original song?
The name of the original song was Another Country. It's by Richard Farina.
No, what was the date? What was the date of publication of the original song?
1964.
Well, in 64, there's always a possibility it was never registered.
No, I did eventually find it. I'm sorry, I did find that one. I'm looking for someone else, and I've been in contact with that individual's personal assistant, but I still haven't had results from that, and I still don't know who owns the copyright for that. But it was an extraordinarily difficult thing to find. I had to go to a book, find other lyrics, find that artist.
Unless Paul has a magic wand, I, from my perspective, it's always difficult.
Paul Rapp, do you have a magic wand, sir?
I don't. I wish I had a magic wand, but I don't. But you know, if it doesn't show up at copyright.gov in their database, and if it goes back to 64, it may not, because I think they're trying to digitize their records, but I'm not sure how far they go back. These days,
I know monies are supposedly being allocated to digitize everything and create a database that actually is searchable. But right now, I haven't done it much, but it seems very difficult.
It is very difficult. And also, it would lead me to the right to the copyrights for performing the song, using the jingle of the song, if there was such a thing. But that's an outsourced company that has no idea about the original company that owns the copyright for anything that they are, in fact, managing only within that area, which is not the area I needed. I needed it for print reproduction.
Uh-huh.
Have you checked the databases for BMI and ASCAP?
Oh, good idea.
You know, most popular songs.
Yeah, I have. They're not. The one is not there. No. In any case, I've pretty much solved my problem. I hope right now. But I was hoping that you could give me a hint if I ever had to do this again, which I don't foresee. Mm. Or you could help other people and find an easy forum to find who owns the copyright for what any one particular song.
That's interesting.
It doesn't exist.
So, Paul, if it doesn't exist, and assuming that a copyright attorney like yourself would be called in, how do you go about doing that sleuthing?
I mean, just as we just said, I mean, a general internet search is good. Searching the copyright office's database, then you go to you try BMI and ASCAP to see if perhaps it's registered there, and there's some publishing or ownership information there. And at this point, that's what you do. And you know, hopefully, like Bill said, they're finally putting money into digitizing the historic copyright records. So hopefully in the next, 3 to 5 years or so, you'll be able to go online and it'll be a user-friendly search, but we're not there yet.
All right, but if Leonard failed, if you did the search at the site as it is, and then you went to ASCAP and BMI, and still you struck out, is there another step? If the internet search terms up nothing, can you assume? Assuming is never really a good idea in legal matters, I'm told. But can you assume then, all right, I can go ahead and put this in the book?
You can't assume that, although I think your risk, you know, if you can't find the owner after a diligent and comprehensive search with everything that's available right now, depending on the situation, I would encourage a client just to go ahead and publish it, you know, and if somebody shows up, then you make a deal. I mean, this is a classic orphan works, what's referred to as an orphan work situation. Now, there is some risk that somebody's going to show up and make a big stink about it. I don't know that a court would be very receptive to the copyright holder's argument if the copyright holder's been out there essentially hiding or not findable. You know, I'm always in favor of publishing things rather than not publishing things. And if somebody is so lax in their copyright ownership that they can't be found, there's a very good chance they're not going to show up once you publish something.
And so I
would go ahead and do it in most situations. I would want to see the situation first, though.
But as a word of caution, if you're in that situation and you do that, document your search very carefully.
Yes, good suggestion.
But if I'm a judge, I'm sorry, I'm going to say, well, I don't really care how many things you look through. You didn't look all the way because here is the owner of the copyright. How am I going to find against this owner of the copyright?
Well,
Go ahead, Paul. I mean, you, the copyright owner is not going to lose. It's just his damages are going to be driven down to the point of a reasonable licensing fee, a couple hundred bucks.
Understood. You know? We're joined today by Paul Rapp and Bill Westwood. The number here is 800-348-2551. Copyright Forum today. We go to Wendy in Suffield, Connecticut. Wendy, you're on. Hello, Wendy.
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Hello. I'm calling about a small church that I belong to in Connecticut, and we, I believe, have what's called a one license for printing music that may not be in our hymnal, but we want people to sing in the service. And that seemed to be sufficient. I don't know all what it covers, but the people that were involved at the time seemed to think it was sufficient for our needs. And the question has come up now that we live stream the services on Zoom. Is that same kind of license applicable? The services right now are not recorded, but they are streamed or by phone on Zoom.
Okay.
Boy, excellent question. I don't know. I would have to see the original license. I would think generally, though, that the answer would be no, because the original license covered, you know, a fairly modest audience. That is, the people that would fit into your church. And now with Zoom, you could have a much, much wider license. But I would want to look at the terms of the original license. And go back.
Yeah, it's called the name of the license is the one. It's just called the one license. The other license that people seem to get is called CCLI. Are you familiar with that?
Is that Creative Commons?
It sounds like. I'm afraid I don't know what the letters stand for. CCLI.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not familiar with either of those terms.
Okay.
But I would look at the actual agreement and start there. And you know, if in your understanding of reading the license, it covers a Zoom conference, I would go ahead and continue to operate under that license.
Yeah, I mean, it may not probably deal with that topic in particular because it's so. You know,
it's new, yeah,
phenomenon. But anyway, thank you.
All right.
Thanks,
Wendy. And let us know go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, sir, I couldn't have a better answer for you.
Let us know if you find out anything, Wendy, and if you get sued. We appreciate the call. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Well, you know, it's all showbiz, right? Dory in Schenectady. Dory, you're on.
Hi, I'm a knitter, and I'm often downloading patterns and sell what I make. I have run across several times people after the download, not beforehand, stating that by purchasing this pattern, you've agreed to not sell the item because it's my copyright.
Uh-huh.
My understanding of copyright law is that you own the pattern and the pictures. I can print it out and make a paper airplane with it. As long as I don't sell it or redistribute your pattern, what I make from it is mine. Is that accurate?
I don't think so. Paul?
Hello?
Hello. They're thinking it over.
Oh, yeah, okay. I think so. Bill, you're thinking it's a derivative work.
Yes.
Okay.
If they have, let's say for the sake of argument, they're making a pair of mittens with wool and silk, and that's what they list in their pattern, and I make them blue instead of green, and I make them with alpaca, is it still a derivative work?
It would seem to me, and Paul, please weigh in on this, but it would seem to me that it would depend on what's copyrighted. If the artwork discussion, which is the pattern, if that is what's copyrighted, if that's considered copyrightable, then your reproduction of that, whether it's in a different material or a different color, would still arguably be an infringement. But I'm interested in what Paul says on this.
Paul?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay.
You know, I mean, merely by making the sweater, you know, by that argument, merely by making the sweater, it would be an infringement by creating it. So, you know, and if you make 5 sweaters from the pattern and give them away to your family, that would be an infringement because it, you know, it doesn't matter if you're selling it or not. If you're distributing it, that would still be under the copyright law an infringement. So, yeah, I don't think that by making a sweater from a pattern that you bought, and the pattern's protected by copyright, the instructions, I don't think the sweater itself is going to be, that seems to me like a nonsensical result.
But you're talking about a single sweater. If you make multiple sweaters and then go out and sell them, that's what I would.
If you make multiple sweaters and give them away, I mean that would be bit as much of an infringement, right?
Well, sure,
I mean,
that
would be a distribution, right? And
right.
So, you know, selling it.
Well,
let's just stop at distribution.
My argument was always that the selling was a non-starter, that the actual pattern is the copyright, because otherwise.
Yes.
How do you go from a runway to Target?
Ah. That's another
because
show.
Those are those uses at Target have been licensed by Target or someone like that.
But I'm saying if you have an off-brand is what I mean. If you have an off-brand, this is not a. I don't know if it's a linear argument or not, or if I'm looking at it the wrong way. And part of my issue with this is that the copyright was not in the download information. They put it in the actual pattern after the download. So you don't see that notice until after
you download
it.
Well, trust me, there are a lot of instructions like that are wrong, wrong morally.
Yeah, I was like,
and it shouldn't be that way. I agree with that. I'm just saying if the pattern itself is what's protected, then, you know, they might have some standing. You'd almost have to look at the original copyright registration to see what was protected, in my mind.
I see.
All right.
And that's assuming that they didn't just write copyright on the bottom and actually registered it. So I'd have to do some research.
Well, that's true. That's very, very true.
Well, Dory, thanks a lot for the call. But, Paul, just by creating the work, you've essentially copyrighted it, right?
Seems to be.
Yeah, but that doesn't give you any oomph in a court case.
All right, let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Copyright Forum. More coming up. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you, 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum. Bill Westwood, one of the leading medical illustrators in the whole wide world. Paul Rapp, an intellectual property lawyer and writer, and they are both here to answer your intellectual property questions. And I mentioned this at the top of the show, Winnie the Pooh. And The Sun Also Rises are now public as of the first of the year. Hundreds of thousands of sound recordings from before 1923 are now available. There's Buster Keaton movies, all kinds of stuff we can watch and listen to for free now, Paul Rapp. Isn't that exciting?
Yes, it is. And I believe it's up to now 1925, is it not?
I think it's from 26, isn't it?
Yeah, the 26? Article said 26. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones, and we go to Kevin and Gardner. Kevin, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a question regarding, music licensing for radio shows or podcasts that are archived. The premise would be if a radio show that has a licensing to play music, they broadcast their show, and then they... then the show gets archived and can be restreamed through podcast platforms or whatever else. Does that original licensing cover the ability to replay those programs?
You're talking about licenses here from ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, etc. The answer, I believe, is generally no, but a lot of radio stations do it anyways. And, you know, I believe I have not looked deeply into it, but I believe that ASCAP, BMI probably have adjusted their licenses now to accommodate it. I think my recommendation would be if you run a radio station, go ahead and archive. And, you know, when BMI and ASCAP come calling, if they do, and they don't always, renegotiate the license at that time.
We have this, and we don't really do a lot of music archiving here on our podcasts and whatnot, but NPR has negotiated a deal, and we are an NPR affiliate, so we have to log everything, and we have to provide data on a quarterly basis, so ASCAP, BMI, et cetera, get paid, but there is a blanket license that NPR has. All we got to do is... abide by the rules of the agreement, basically, Kevin.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for the call. Number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Copyright Forum today with Bill Westwood and Paul Rapp. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, Polly Law usually with us. Polly drew the short straw this time, and we only have two phone guest lines. When we do the round table, it's not a call-in show, so we can use some of these phone lines that our callers will use for guests, but we can't do that on this show. So Paul and Bill with us today, and hopefully by the next time we do this, guys, we will not have any restrictions about having you in the studio. It's a little tougher to do, isn't it?
Well, that would be nice, but hey.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys don't sound that. You don't sound that thrilled about being here. So maybe we'll just continue.
No, I'm always thrilled about being there.
Do it over the phone.
Me.
All right. Let's go to Michael in Northampton. Michael, you're on.
Hi there. If I have taken a picture of myself and I load it up somewhere, I don't officially have a copyright for it. But then somebody takes that picture and posts it on their website. Have they violated my copyright?
Yes.
You want to expound?
You have a copyright. You have a copyright on that image from the moment you make it. You just haven't registered it with the Copyright Office.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Go ahead, Michael.
I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say, if they have not given any credit to where the source was, they're in violation.
It's not a matter of it's not a matter of credit. It's you know, they can't reproduce it without your okay. Now, keep in mind, if you shared the picture on social media of yourself, if you posted a picture of yourself on social media and somebody then went and shared it, and you complained, you know, and they're not using it for a commercial purpose, if they're not using it to sell something, the kind of societal norm is going to be on the side of the person that shared the photograph, because and it may not be legal in terms of a strict reading of copyright law, but, you know, social media being what it is, it encourages, and the architecture encourages, and in fact, the same can be said for the entire internet, encourages sharing and reproduction. And, you know, when something goes viral, it's generally a case of mass copyright infringement on a hyper-technical level.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
You know, I mean, if they're using it for a commercial purpose, if they're using it for an advertisement, you know, and we see this all the time with people, you know, downloading things and putting them on their commercial websites and then getting nicked by someone representing the copyright owner. You know, that's different. But if you're just sharing it, hey, look at this great picture that someone, you know, posted, you know, or look at this goofy person. You know, I mean, if it's on a non-commercial basis, you can probably get them to take it down, but you also run the risk of looking like, you know, looking like somebody that really doesn't know what's going on.
Well, Paul, what about the case just in the last few weeks where the celebrity photographer took a picture of a celebrity? The celebrity got a copy of it and posted it, and she was just convicted of copyright infringement for posting the photographer's picture of her.
Wow.
How did she do it, like, on her own website? Did she do it in some kind
I don't recall. I'm sorry. I don't have the details. I thought it was on Instagram, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm sure somebody out there that's read about this will correct me. But I'd sort of been following that at a distance, and I just saw something about it in the last week or two and was actually going to dig into it and write something about it, and then got busy with a deadline and didn't. But it was very interesting.
Oh, that is interesting. Well, hopefully we'll have some more details on that one for the next one. Let's go to Michael in Salem, New York. Michael, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
I have two questions. I've been in the art publishing business most of my life, and I've got a lot of different information.
after someone dies, 75 years after an artist dies, that their artwork goes out of copyright is one question. And number two is, can you digitally reproduce artwork that they've done after a certain number of time? And what is that time?
Paul Rapp.
The author, a work will go to the public domain. And of course, this depends, of course, on whether the work was originally created before 1978 or after 1978, because the copyright laws changed. Assuming it was after 1978, it's 70 years after the death of the author, or if the author is deemed to have been a corporation by the work
or if it's
laws,
work for hire.
If it's a work for hire, then it's 95 years after creation. Right, Bill?
The copyright protection lasts for the life of the author plus an additional 70 years, not 75.
70.
Okay,
yes.
So let's say the author is dead. I can digitally for 70 years plus, I can digitally reproduce artwork, maps they made, anything that they produced before, in their lifetime.
If the work was originally created after January 1st, 1978, if it was initially created before that, then you've got some issues on your hand. You have to do some research. If you Google copyright slide rule, digital copyright slide rule, you will come upon, and a number of institutions have published a very easy to use tool that will tell you whether the work is in the public domain, whether it might be in the public domain and you've got to do some more work, or whether it's definitely not in the public domain.
Okay, one quick question more.
Okay.
If a museum seems to think they own the copyright to the artwork for a Matisse or a Monet or something, and we want to publish that, is that true that they own the copyright, or is it go by the artist?
We've done this before.
They like to pretend that they do, or make it appear that they do, so they can charge you for high-res reproductions.
Correct.
But they don't.
Correct. Yes.
It's a Matisse, you can find high-res reproductions anywhere, and they're all in the public domain.
There you go.
Yeah, but you've got to make sure it's in the public domain, because if you take an image that's been taken by some photographer who owns that image, and you use that image, then you have problems.
But if you're
a photograph of a public domain, you can't take a picture of a public domain work and do everything you can to make it look exactly like the public domain work and suddenly claim copyright for it. There have been court cases where, the photographer said, look, we spent weeks doing the lighting and we had expensive equipment. And, the court said, all you're trying to do is make an exact reproduction of a public domain work. The amount of work you put into it doesn't matter, because you're not adding what counts for creativity in terms of copyright law into this.
Paul Rapp is with us at Bill Westwood to answer your intellectual property questions. And let's go to Petersburg. Kathleen, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because I'm calling. There's a business that went defunct probably, back in the 1960s. It burned down. It's nearby. But we found someone gave us a copy of a really cool poster of this business. I want to be able, it does not have a copyright on it anywhere. I would like to make copies of it and actually do some digital work to make other things with it. Is that
is it artwork or a photograph?
It's a poster, so it's mostly photographs and graphics.
It's original poster from the 1960s?
The thing is, it has no date on it, so We had the original that a friend lent us. It's probably, I know that the company, the business burned down probably late 60s, early 70s.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Chances are it's in the public domain if it was published before, what was the date, Bill? It was like 1989 or 1990 without, if you published
19,
it without a copyright.
Yeah, 1987, actually, I think.
Yeah, if it was published without a copyright notice on it, it automatically went into the public domain, huh. Which was really, really harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a hiatus there, which a lot of us got caught in without being fully aware. And so some of my works from those periods are actually in the public domain.
Public domain.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And so you're free to do with it what you will. From what it sounds like, yeah.
You mean, Paul, if there is no little C with a circle, no copyright indication at all on that piece of paper that is the poster, she's free to go ahead?
Yeah, I would say so.
Unless it was registered, the new copyright law, okay, which was passed in 1978, left this opening, and a lot of work, in it sort of inadvertently, at least from my perspective, fell into the public domain.
Well, Kathleen, good luck. Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. Barbara in Niskayuna. Barbara, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two questions.
Okay.
One is, if I wanted to write short stories but use song titles as the subject of the story,
yeah,
does that have to be copyrighted, or do I have to get permission if I'm going to use the title of a song? And then my second question is, if you have a company that wants to have some work done and they want to do before and after pictures, which they'll probably end up putting on their website, is that something that needs to be copywritten?
Two questions there, completely separate. Paul.
The first question is, titles can't be copyrighted. They're too short. And as a matter of policy, the Copyright Office won't register a title. So you're free to use the title. Be careful if you start using the lyrics. That might be considered infringement. But just using a title is fine. In terms of your before and after pictures, I presume that the doctor, since you're not the one that's taking the photographs, the photographer would actually be the one whose copyrights are implicated. However, they would probably want to get a release from you for your, privacy and publicity interests in using your face for purposes of advertising.
I think it's home renovations, Paul. I think it's home renovations.
Oh, home renovations.
Not face renovations, which we could all use, frankly.
I said getting some work done. I thought we were talking about,
I'll tell you one thing, Barbara. If I was going to do that, I would say, all right, where's my discount? If you're going to use this, I want a discount on the work.
Yeah, well, and if they're using your photographs, if you're using your photographs, I would register the copyrights just to make sure that the use is limited to the uses that you've approved.
Okay. So if I'm taking them, I should copyright them. If I allow them to take them, then I should, one, I have to sign a release, and two, I should ask for a discount.
You betcha, Barbara. And tell them Paul Rapp sent you. No, don't do that. Hey, listen, we're about out of time, Barbara. Thank you very much for the call. Paul Rapp, how do people find you on the internet?
I can be reached at paul@paulrapp.com.
Paulrapp.com. Well, thank you, sir, for being here. Bill Westwood, your website.
Westwoodmedical.com, or you can just Google Bill or William Westwood.
Hey, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Hopefully, as I say, next time we will be back in the studio, but great job muddling through all the technicals here, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
Support comes from Interim Healthcare, working to help people remain safe in their homes, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, announcing employment opportunities, interimhealthcare.com. At ArtSpark, Saratoga Springs, New York, I can't even say the name of the state. Let's try it again. ArtSpark, Saratoga Springs, New York, helping artists with the business of being an artist, artspark.com. Well, there you go. It's a new low. Even by my standards, I can't say the name of the state that I live in. There we are. That's it for Vox Pop today. Thanks to Bill Westwood and Paul Rapp for being here on the phone. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who has suffered greatly over these last couple of years doing this phone show. And yeah, well, you know, you don't get much but thanks. So thanks, Zach. And thanks to Jordan Yuxall, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Yeehaw! We'll see you then.